Find her expert advice anytime at thinkblink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Blink Show, live on Sundays, 11 to 1, here on News Talk WSB. So glad you could join us today. Great show. We are going to talk real estate. This is a big surprise in our continuing saga of rebuilding America, one house at a time. I wanted to give you some new tools, some new perspectives today. So we're going to be talking with Jed Kolko. He's the chief economist for Trulia in just a moment. And then we've got a big-time real estate investing guy, Grant Cardone. He's also a sales training expert and a motivational speaker and a New York Times bestselling author. We're going to talk to him. Then we're going to get a little different picture of the foreclosure market, talking with some people from Realty Track. They really have just an eye on the numbers for that sort of thing. And then we're going to go back to real estate investing and talk with Steve Cook, managing editor of Real Estate Economy Watch, on some things that he sees happening over in Washington, D.C. So I think it's going to be a great show. Glad you can join us for it. Our number 404-872-0750. If you're not online and following me on Twitter, well, what can I say? You're missing half the conversation. So follow me right now, Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And go to thinkglink.com, my website, sign up for our free weekly newsletter, be on top of all of the information coming to you from us here at ThinkLink. All right, let's turn right now to Jed Kolko. He's chief economist of Trulia, based in San Francisco. Jed, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Elise, thanks so much for having me.
So the housing recovery has, I really felt like in 2012 it turned the tide and we were starting to see some really good seeds planted. Finally, I think that all the people who'd been calling for the bottom in the market the last 5 years finally were right, which just proves the point that if you just keep calling the bottom, someday you will be right. But here we are in 2013, and my sense is that the rebuilding has picked up pace and we're seeing some good numbers. And I wanted to have you on the show because I think you sit in a little different seat. You know, Trulia is a web presence, and it definitely has consumers interacting with real estate agents. You've got a lot of good content on there. But from where you sit, you know, where do you see 2013 working out?
We see the recovery as finally picking up steam. It's been a long time coming. When we look over the past few years, we've had so many years of prices struggling to turn around, very low construction, a lot of extra inventory and high vacancy rates. And that all really started to change finally in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Coming into 2013, a lot of that recovery is now accelerating. So the price gains that we saw coming in 2012 are actually picking up steam right now. And pretty much every place in the country that saw those huge price declines after the housing bubble burst is now seeing a price rebound.
But the rebound is not going to be like the stock market, where in 6 months we go from 6,600 to 13,000, right?
No, housing markets are very different than the stock market. The stock market can turn around in a day or a matter of seconds even, whereas there are very few day traders in homes.
Well, there are a few, but they kind of lost, some of them lost their shirts, I have to say.
But it's hard to trade homes really quickly. Mm-hmm. And most of the decisions about whether to buy or sell or rent a home take a lot of time to make. Construction takes months or even over a year in the case of large buildings. And even when people want to make a move, it can take months to sell a home, more time to move. And so the housing market doesn't tend to go up and down as quickly as the stock market. And it means it also typically takes years for our housing market to recover after the kind of bubble bust that we saw.
Well, you've got a truly a housing barometer, and in it it says that the market's now 51% back to normal, and last year we were only 28% back to normal. So what does that actually mean? What is normal, and what do you mean by that? Because I think some people are going to listen to that and go, wow, we're halfway back to where my house was at, 2005.
Yeah, there was nothing about 2005 or 2006 that was normal. Those were the years where we saw lots of overbuilding, especially in some of the more suburban, sprawling areas and a lot of sunbelt
like Atlanta
cities. That was not a normal moment. Now, of course, there's never a moment or a day where you can say that the housing market finally is normal, but you can look at the longer-term historical averages. What's the typical amount of construction that we need in order to house all of the families that are formed each year. You know, what's the typical amount of sales? What's the typical rate at which people are unable to make their home payments and are falling behind? And when you look at those long-term normals, that's what we're trying to judge today against. And when we look at where we are today relative to that normal and relative to where we were at the worst point of the housing bust, right now we're about halfway back to normal. That means between roughly 2009, and that was really the point where the housing market was in the worst shape, and normal levels, we're about halfway back. It's taken us three years from that bottom to get halfway back.
Right. So halfway back, though, again, I want to make sure that everybody who's listening is really clear. We don't mean that your home prices are halfway back to what you thought of was normal in 2005 when everybody was fighting to get their hands on it. So home prices that fell, and in the Atlanta market, they've fallen in some cases 50, 60, even 65, 70% in some neighborhoods. It's not like home prices are halfway back to where they were.
That's totally right.
Just be really clear so nobody calls the show going, and where's mine?
Right. The home prices in 2005 and 2006 were way out of line with what the market could sustain. And we saw what happened once prices got that unreasonably high, and that is prices burst.
So all we're really talking about here is demand and supply.
That's right.
Okay. So good news or bad news for the economy? Because, you know, a lot of jobs came out of the building. We've lost a huge number of real estate agents, a huge number of mortgage lenders, huge number of construction workers. I mean, the whole industry is just contracted. I like to say that new home building is actually in a depression, down still about 75 to 80% from its high, which by any stretch of the imagination is, you know, a major wipeout. What do you think?
We are now starting to see, just at the very beginning of starting to see the housing market give back to the economy. For the past few years, it's really the economy that was starting to drag the housing market along. As we had more job growth, more people going back to work, that helped housing demand. You know, when you've got a job, you're in a better position to buy or to rent your own place than if you're unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
We're just now starting to see construction jobs pick up. There has been a little bit of construction recovery already. Construction in 2012 was up more than a quarter relative to 2011, so there is some construction pickup, but we haven't seen that yet in the number of construction jobs. So far, it's really been a jobless construction recovery.
Which is sort of interesting because we've seen a jobless recovery after the last several recessions, including 2000, where I'm not sure we ever really recovered until maybe we were at the heat of the bubble here, and then we were recovered, and suddenly now we're in a much worse place on the economic side. So it seems as though, you talk about glass half empty, glass half full, but this is really a problem. If people don't get jobs, they're not buying real estate.
Jobs overall are recovering, but it's the construction sector jobs that are lagging more behind. And so that's really, that holds back the economy in local markets that typically have had a building boom over the past many years. So some of the fastest growing markets in the country, like the inland parts of Southern California, east of Los Angeles, Phoenix, Vegas, you know, those are places where the construction industry was an important part of the local economy. And without more construction jobs, that's going to hold back those local economies.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm having a conversation with Jed Kolka. He's chief economist of Trulia, which is a real estate website, Trulia.com. So, Jed, let's go local, right? Here we are in Atlanta. We have, you know, one of the epicenters for the housing crisis, clearly. I mean, we were just bombarded with foreclosures, bombarded with short sales. I mean, at one point in time, I think HUD had 50,000 homes for sale in Georgia, and that number was only going up no matter how many people were buying it. So we're seeing, you know, in Atlanta, a real price depreciation. Prices have rolled all the way back to 1998 in some cases. And that's a long time ago to roll back prices 14 years. It just shows you sort of the lack of demand and how, you know, many foreclosures there are. What is your sense of where we are with Atlanta? And what kind of recovery is in store?
Atlanta has actually very recently now started to see a pretty significant price turnaround. As you said, prices fell a lot in Atlanta, including just in the past couple of years prior to now. But Atlanta in 2012 actually was one of the biggest turnaround markets in the country.
So what does that mean exactly?
So that means that prices in Atlanta were actually up 9% year over year. When we look just at, you know, at the past few weeks, and we look at asking prices, because that's a leading indicator of where sales prices are going. It hasn't even shown up yet in the sales prices, but we're seeing a significant turnaround in prices in Atlanta, and it's very recent.
So let's just add, okay, that's really good news for everybody who's out there. It's 10% or 9% is certainly better than losing 9% in value. But we're also still seeing a pretty high, for pending home sales, we're still seeing a pretty high cancellation rate. The last time I checked, it was still around 15-16%, which means that those deals really aren't earning out. I mean, they're not appraising out. So it's great that prices are going up, but you've got to have some support, or the appraisers are just not going to say yes to this, right?
And so we also need to look at some of the market fundamentals. So prices right now in a lot of markets, including Atlanta, are bouncing back after very big declines. But you have to also look at some of the market fundamentals. And for that, we look at things like job growth, which, you know, if there's no job growth, there can't be strong housing demand. Job growth in Atlanta has actually been reasonably good, sort of in the middle of the pack relative to the rest of the country. Certainly not as fast as job growth
in North Dakota,
in Texas or North Dakota, other places that are really benefiting from that energy boom, or here in the San Francisco Bay Area where I'm calling from, because we've got such a strong tech industry here. At the same time, job growth in the Atlanta area has been much stronger than in a lot of the northeastern and Midwest markets that are actually really struggling on the jobs front.
Okay, so Atlanta's looking pretty good in both of those areas. I mean, I'm sure everybody listening is really delighted to hear that home prices are starting to make a comeback, but I know enough about math to know that when you take a 60% hit, even getting a 9% increase year over year doesn't actually translate into as much as you might hope.
Right. It's a long hill to climb back up. A key milestone of that recovery is going to be when construction comes back. I mentioned that there's been a construction recovery in the U.S. That really hasn't come to Atlanta yet. New building in Atlanta is still way below the long-term historical normal level. And so that's a sign that builders aren't yet ready to bet on Atlanta.
Right. I know that they've been buying up the land, some of the big developments that were sort of an eighth finished have been, you know, turned back to the bank. The banks in some cases have rebooted those. And we are seeing them come back. But, of course, the prices that they're selling those homes at, the new ones that are going in, is in many cases half of what somebody who already bought into that existing unit before things went might be half of what they paid. So they may have paid $250, now the new homes are selling for $125. They've got a long road to hoe to get back anywhere close to $250.
Right.
So you
right.
could end up with a whole other wave of foreclosures and short sales.
The foreclosure problem, though, in Atlanta and Georgia as a whole, is actually not among the worst in the country right now. There are other states that have a much slower foreclosure process and a much bigger backlog mm-hmm. of foreclosures, like Florida. That are actually suffering much more from foreclosures.
Hmm. Well, that's good to know for everybody here. If you had one thing to sort of headline what you'd like to see happen this year in Atlanta, what would it be?
One thing I would like to see is, first of all, more inventory. One of the things that has been holding back a lot of markets around the country is a decline in inventory. Partly that's a good thing. There mm-hmm. was too much building during the boom. Now, after many years of little construction, it means that we've swung in the other direction. Hopefully, the rising prices that we've just started to see in the Atlanta area will encourage some homeowners who've been thinking about selling to put their homes on the market and add to inventory.
That sounds good. We are talking with Jed Kolko. He's Trulia.com's chief economist, all the way from San Francisco. Jed, thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you, Lisa. Thanks.
All right. When we come back, we've got Rhonda Duffy, who's going to be in with her real estate insight. And then coming up, we're going to talk with Grant Cardone. He is a big-time real estate investor, training expert, motivational speaker, and New York Times bestselling author. And he has like 300,000 Twitter followers, folks. Don't know why you're not following me. At Glink. Join the conversation. 404-872-0750. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, live on Sundays 11 to 1 here on News Talk WSB. Be sure to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. It's time for Real Estate Insight with Rhonda Duffy. Welcome back, Rhonda.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, great. So there are seven questions that you think you should ask the neighbors before you buy in a neighborhood. What are they?
Absolutely. This is so critical. So, of course, I'm going to post this on my blog, but if people can just get the concept of what we're doing here, I think that would also help them. But you must visit with three sets of neighbors with seven key, what I call core questions. They would be like, is the HOA, the Homeowners Association, are they strict? Are they crazy? You know, that's very, very destructive to someone once they buy and then they figure out they're going to get a fine every time they leave their garbage can out. Some people like that, some people don't. You know, is there an assessment in the future, right? Well, oftentimes there's things that are being planned that the owners won't disclose to a potential buyer. How's the construction on the neighborhood? Have you had any problems yourself? You know, number four would be, how's the neighborhood socially? A lot of people move into neighborhoods thinking they're going to do progressive dinner parties, have great times at the swim tennis area, and that doesn't happen, so you need to know that. How are the amenities? Do they meet the size of the neighborhood? Number six would be, you know, are the neighbors mostly, you know, good people? Whatever these people, these buyers are forecasting in their mind that they would be with, meaning is there crime here? Are there a lot of teenagers? You know, somebody who's an empty nester may not want to deal with a neighborhood full of teenagers. So these are all questions that they can discover through the neighborhood. And also, why are these particular neighbors of yours moving? And have they had any trouble with their property? So the basis there is the neighbors know everything.
And I think that's really true. I mean, if you're buying in a new housing development, I always say go knock on the doors of the neighbors and see how the developers actually panned out. How did they like the house? Did it hold up? And what? How has the developer been about coming back? So neighbors know all.
Three sets of them.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Real Estate Insight with Rhonda Duffy, rhondaduffy.com for the blog and a little bit more on all of those questions. Rhonda, thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll see you next week.
You bet. All right, stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Scott Slade here, host of Atlanta's Morning News on News Talk WSB. Tune in Monday morning and every day for weather and traffic every 6 minutes, plus live team coverage of the top stories now starting at 4:30 a.m. on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show on News Talk WSB. We are live every Sunday, 11 to 1. Our number, 404-872-0750, online, the website, thinkglink, thinkglink.com, and sign up there for the free weekly newsletter. And if you're not following me on Twitter, you are missing half the conversation, especially today, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, because the person we're going to talk to next, Grant Cardone, has something like a million followers on Twitter. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He does a lot of real estate investing, but a lot of motivational speaking. And I thought in this whole spirit of rebuilding America one house at a time, yours, mine, and your neighbors, that we should talk to Grant a little bit about what brings success. Right? I promised you at the beginning of the year that it didn't really matter if you're a small business owner, you're just trying to draw a line in your sand, move forward with your personal finances, or you just want to rebuild your own world. We're going to give you the tools to do it. Grant, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So your success is really interesting because you've built all of these different places. Give everybody who's listening just a little bit of a perspective of where you've come from, because I think your story is such a good one.
Well, I grew up in a lower middle class family. My dad died when I was 10, so my mother was left to bring up three boys, and I was brought up under this scarcity mentality and shortage. Like everything, I remember leaving my bedroom, and my mom, every time I left, turn that light off.
Right.
It was not, you know, every time I left my bedroom, you can have anything you want, you can create anything you want. There's abundance. it was always about shortages. And that was about self-preservation and survival for her, because she remembered being a child growing up in food lines. So fast forward 30 years, you know, I made a decision when I was, I guess, 16 years old. I'm like, I cannot live like this my whole life. I have to create enough abundance in my life, enough so that I'm not scared in scarcity all the time.
Did you have a number in mind when you thought that at 16? Did it even mean anything to you?
No, I just knew. Well, one, I wanted a father. I mean, I didn't really want money. I wanted a father. You know, I'm like, oh, man, what if I just had a dad like all the other guys? And it was really like, if I'm ever in a position in my life, if I ever have enough money, I'm going to help other people that don't have mentors and direction. Well, there's a lot of middle-class America that doesn't have direction today. You could have a mom and a dad, and a lot, you could be living with mom and dad. But the truth is, the middle class is getting crushed today, based on the same themes and policies that my mother used are not working for most of America today. This idea of scarcity, stay small, be conservative, save all your money.
Why do you think it's not working? Where do you think the breakdowns occurred? Because I think there's a tremendous psychic breakdown for most of America between what was always visualized, right? Manifest destiny, the idea that you could move west, move on, move up, and you could change your life and change your circumstances. That belief in yourself as future and vision, I think, has broken down dramatically over the last 5 years specifically, but even the last 10 or 15 years, as we've gone through one kind of soul-crushing experience after another.
Well, I think it's because of the soul crushing. I think people are like, my God, man, can I even do this? I did everything they told me to do. I went and bought a house, and now I'm underwater in my house $100,000. You know, I went and got in business for myself, and then that didn't work. They told me I should get credit, and I got credit. I ended up with 7 or 8 credit cards, and now they're telling me I shouldn't have 7 or 8 credit cards. I mean, it's just a lot of stuff has been taken away from people that people were convinced to do. I went and got a college degree, and now I can't get a job. See, some of the things that my dad, my mom and my dad used, some of the policies and rules and some of the good things to create a middle class, are not the same things you would use to sustain one or continue to grow it. For instance, saving money. You know, it's a great idea to save money, and it's a great idea to control your spending, but it's not a way to create financial freedom. You can't. I've been studying financially successful people for 30 years. None of them had their focus on saving money or on their spending. The truly successful, at least financially, people that have real financial security and freedom had no attention on saving money and had no attention on the reduction of expenditures. What they had their attention on was the creation of capital, the growth of money, to actually take and expand into a market, not contract into it. The last 5 years, all of America, most of America, is in this monster kind of contraction, backing up, retreating, conserving everything, and you can't expand while you're trying to protect.
So when you were young and you made this decision that you were going to expand your opportunities, that you were going to create abundance in your life, and I went through so much of this myself and lost, maybe there's something about losing your dad. I lost mine when I was 18. This idea that you've one of the great pillars of your life just gets kicked out from under you and the stool starts to collapse and you have no one else but yourself to right that and to strengthen it and to build and go forward. So maybe there's something there as well. But when you made that decision, what would you say was the next important step that you took that got you where you needed to go? Was it this, you know, looking at 30 years worth of financially successful people and trying to figure out what made them successful? Did you take a risk on a business?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, I think the first thing I did was, you know, I did the traditional stuff. I went and got a college degree. It never helped me. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about college, but I owed the government $40,000. I got out of college, and I didn't know how to get a job. I mean, if you don't know how to get a job, you know, it doesn't matter how much you know.
Right. That's true.
There's a lot of smart people. Smart has no value in the marketplace. Smart's not the problem. The problem, the first decision I made was this. I cannot live in scarcity every day. I am not going to live scared to turn off the lights. You should be able to weigh some things and not worry about it. So I knew when I was 16, oh my gosh, the only solution is to get out of the middle class. Because the middle class that I was in was one that was built on every message was, oh, you got a car, you should be grateful. You have clothes, you should be grateful. You have food, you should be grateful. You get three meals a day, you should be grateful. There's people starving on this planet. I heard that every day, and I'm like, this does not work for most people, this idea to just be grateful. So there must be something else. Oh, I know what it is. Go get out of this mentality. Create enough survival for yourself and enough abundance for yourself that you could actually help people, even people that aren't related to you. And before the show, I was telling you that. That's what really drives me. I want to help other people. And that takes money. I hate to say it, but we're not in the time of Jesus 2,000 years ago where you called your neighbors up and everybody built a house together. Now we are in the 21st century. It's very competitive. The world could take your job. Technology shifts extremely fast. But what there's a shortage of, what there's massive shortages of, are people that are excellent. People that not are smart, but people that want to really deliver excellent quality service, a product, or an idea.
Well, this is a good time to tell people that they should go to your website, CardoneSuccess.com, CardoneSuccess.com, and sign up for your new, you have a newsletter as well that sort of talks about your different success strategies. When you are doing this grant, and you do, you know, your businesses are motivational speaking, and you've written these New York Times bestsellers, which are great. If you go to his Twitter page, at Grant Cardone, you'll actually see four of his four bestsellers. Very neat little picture that you have up there. But then also you've gotten into real estate, which is, again, a harbinger of great wealth for so many Americans. Because even on a small scale, real estate can pay off big time for you. I mean, if nothing else, just pay the mortgage and you end up with a lump sum at the end of that term. Is that why you made the decision to move in that way?
Well, you can't read more than two or three success stories. I'm talking about the old guys, you know, back in that came out of the 20s. They all owned real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, America got that a little confused because they didn't study quite deep enough, and they thought that meant, you know, to go buy a house. Look, a house is a place to live and raise your kids. It's not a place to have money invested. Everybody needs a roof. I need a safe place to raise, you know, have my marriage and create my, you know, have my kids and go home at night and rest. But the kind of real estate that I've been buying my whole career was real estate that produced revenue. And it goes along this line, Elise, that I was saying earlier. It's about expansion. You want something that expands you and creates more flows. It doesn't really matter what you're doing. You could be a salesperson, a receptionist, a shipper, a web developer. Your value in the world, in regarding the economy, comes from your ability to drive revenue, multiple flows of revenue. So even if I'm the receptionist, the more valuable I am to the company at assisting the company and not just handling the phone, but driving revenue, the more value I have to the company. The more value I have to myself and my family as a husband, as a father, as a good example, is my ability to drive more revenue to the family to give us more choices. And that's why I absolutely love multifamily real estate. I've been buying it for 25 years. I own almost 2,000 apartments today, but I started with 2 units, and then I went to 12 units, and then I went to 38 units. I started like everybody else. I started small.
And I just saw that press release that came out. You just bought a really significant chunk of units in Florida, right?
That's right. I moved from L.A. to Florida, and I've just bought about 1,500 units here in town. Or
just
here
a little something local, just to keep you a little bit busy.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the questions that I get all the time is financing investment property, which used to be a lot easier than it is today. Any thoughts there on where, because your partners in this bigger purchase, you had some pretty significant sized partners. You're not using your own money anymore.
No. I'm using my money as the equity, but I'm using Fannie Mae. You know, look, it's easier to get a loan on a multifamily than it is a house. Because they're not lending me the money, just me the money. I mean, I have to be good for it. They're not looking at my credit so much as or my ability to pay it back. They're looking at my ability to make those properties operate.
Right, and that's really sort of where it goes. You know, I want to continue this conversation. We have to take a short break. When we come back, could you give us a couple of tips for somebody who is starting out today and is thinking about real estate, because this is, you know, again, everything that we do in the show is about rebuilding your life, rebuilding America, and figuring out what the steps are going to be. So if you could come up with a couple of quick steps for us, we will come back in just a moment. We're talking with Grant Cardone. He is a New York Times best-selling author. His books are terrific. You can find them on Amazon, or you can go to his Twitter, be a Twitter follower. He's got like a million of them, at Grant Cardone. His website, CardoneSuccess.com. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. We're talking with Grant Cardone. He is a real estate investor, big time, 2,000 units. He is a New York Times bestselling author. You can find him on Twitter, at Grant Cardone, or at CardoneSuccess.com. You can also find more information about him at our website, thinkglink.com. So, Grant, when we left off, you were going to give us three strategies for people who are thinking about getting into real estate investing. What can they do today to get started?
Well, first thing is decide, hey, I'm going to go out and actually create more. You're going to create wealth for yourself. Get out of the middle class should be your calling, your mantra right now. I'm going to get out and above the middle class so that I'm not, you know, beat up and pulled behind the truck like it's happening to millions of people that are literally just being dragged across the gravel financially. So the first thing is make that decision. Now what we have to do is produce more revenue. You have to produce more revenue at your current job or second job so you actually have money to invest. It's not enough to tell somebody, oh, just go invest in real estate. Well, dude, I don't have any money. And you can't just save more money. It's just not going to produce enough to invest. So first thing is figure out creative ways to produce more revenue, either at the job you're at or by getting a second job. Number two, you have to save that money and treat it like it is you will not use it for any other thing. Okay, this is sacred money. You will not touch it under any case, because what you're going to do is you're going to save that in step two until you have enough to actually go out and buy property that will produce cash flow, a positive cash flow from day one. You're not going to buy a piece of property that might be worth more money tomorrow or next month or next year or in the future. It must produce positive cash flow, and I would look for at least an 8% cash flow after debt, after expenses, after everything to do with managing that property. You're going to have 8% on your $100,000 investment. It's going to pay you $8,000 a year, and then spend your time making that property function and operate better.
I think those are great suggestions. Folks, we have to say goodbye to Grant just simply because we've got things to do, and so does he. But, Grant, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Follow Grant Cardone, at Grant Cardone on Twitter, CardoneSuccess.com, one of many websites that he has. But he's got a free newsletter you can sign up for. And if you sign up for it, you'll get something called the Top 50 Qualities of Great Salespeople, which is something I'm going to sign up for as well. And we'll have more information up on the thinklink.com blog just as soon as the show is over today. All right, when we come back, we're going to continue our conversations on rebuilding America one house at a time. Stay with us. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time. Here on News Talk WSB, we have Twitter. What's going on with Twitter? Are you following me? I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And if you're not following me on Twitter, well, you are missing half the conversation at least. We have a very active Twitter feed. You should also sign up for my free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to check out today's blog for the show notes for everybody that we've been talking to. You will have all kinds of links and extra information there as well. So check it out, thinkglink.com. And when you have a chance, Equifax Finance blog for all the latest tax information. And, of course, we are launching in another week or so. It might even be, well, it won't be tomorrow. Maybe it'll be tomorrow. This week, I think, we're launching our small business category. So if you are a small business owner and you're looking for some great information, go to the Equifax Finance blog and you'll get it there. Good tax tips for small business owners as well. All right, we have on the phone with us right now Darren Bloomquist. He's vice president of RealtyTrack, a company that tracks foreclosure and other real estate data. And you hear me talk about them all the time when we talk about what's going on with foreclosure statistics. And RealtyTrack has just released its 2012 annual foreclosure review. So, in other words, what happened last year, which hopefully was a better year than 2011. Darren, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, was it a better year?
It was a better year, a slightly better year than 2011. We saw 1.8 million properties with foreclosure filings in 2012, and that was down 3% from 2011 when we saw about 1.9 million properties with foreclosure filings.
Wait, let me just stop you there. What did you say, 1.3 million?
1.8 million.
1.8 million, only down 3%. That's not much of an improvement.
No, and it's not at the national level. And really what's happened in 2012 compared to 2011 is we shifted the bulk of the foreclosure activity from one group of states to the other. And so that's why really at the national level there's not too much difference. If you start drilling down at the state level, you see quite a bit of difference. States with the more streamlined foreclosure process, what's called the non-judicial foreclosure process, those are seeing big decreases in foreclosure activity from a year ago. Places like California, where we saw the numbers down 25% from a year ago.
What about Atlanta, Georgia?
Georgia was not down as dramatically, but it was down 4%. From a year ago, and it is also a non-judicial foreclosure state. Arizona, which is also one of the hardest hit states in the country, was down 33%. And there were 25 states in that category where we saw decreasing foreclosure activity, exactly half. And then the other half, 25 other states, saw increasing foreclosure activity and sometimes pretty dramatic. And these states, most of them, have the more lengthy judicial foreclosure process that has basically postponed some of the foreclosure problem and deferred some of the foreclosure problem in those states. So places like New Jersey, where we saw a 55% increase, that's 5% increase from 2011 to 2012, Florida, a 53% increase, Illinois, a 33% increase, New York, a 31% increase.
It's so unfair. Illinois was so high to begin with. My poor home state. We're broke and we're foreclosure driven. Oy.
Yes, although if you look in 2011, things actually started to look better in Illinois, but it was a bit of fool's gold in my mind. And because
we sent another governor to jail. Nothing looks good in Illinois right now.
Yes. It did get hit hard in 2012.
So when you look at these things, I mean, so let's bring it out a little bit to the 30,000 foot level and just talk a little bit about what this shift means, because we know that the more foreclosures you have in a state, the lower the home prices are going, and yet we see home prices starting to firm in a lot of places, but New Jersey and Illinois get hit. That can't be really good for home prices there.
No, and I think in some of those markets, they're in for a little bit of a rude awakening where things were looking better, appearing to look better in 2012 in terms of home prices and sales. But now with this additional foreclosure inventory coming online, and keep in mind what we're tracking is not properties listed for sale, but properties just entering the foreclosure process. And so many of those that started foreclosure in 2012 are going to end up on the market for sale in 2013. And that's where it's gonna possibly impact home prices. At least, I think we'll see a softening of home prices in some of those markets with that influx of foreclosure inventory.
Now, it's interesting because those markets that you mentioned, and I think there's a few others, the correlation between higher than average unemployment is right there. I mean, Illinois has been higher than average. New Jersey's been a little bit higher. The Northeast in general, I think, is not seen total resurgence of job growth. I mean, even on Wall Street, we're still seeing 10,000 people laid off.
Right.
Are you guys seeing that kind of correlation again between jobs and real estate?
Yes, I think that's one of the factors that's playing into the continued high foreclosure numbers or the increasing foreclosure numbers in some of these states. But I would actually argue that the bulk of this foreclosure activity is in these states is not a sign that the economy or the unemployment situation is worsening all of a sudden in these areas and pushing a lot of new homeowners into foreclosure, but it's simply that these states take longer to deal with foreclosures, and so what would have been a foreclosure in 2011 in California doesn't end up as a foreclosure until 2012 in Florida just because of the longer process.
Right.
And so that, I think, that's really where the strongest correlation is, because out of the 25 states that saw an increase in foreclosure activity, 20 of them had this longer judicial foreclosure process. And so,
Well, I'm sure that people who live in those states are happy that they've had a longer time to sort of adjust to the idea of being kicked out of their house, as opposed to some places where, you know, 90 days out, you're out, or 60 days in some cases.
Yes, Texas is the quickest. It's close to about 90 days, actually, in Texas. And, you know, it's a huge variance, and I think this may be something that we see in looking back 2020 with this whole housing crisis, is an attempt to maybe normalize the different foreclosure processes across the states. But, you know, Texas, you have 90 days. The other extreme is New York, where you have over 1,000 days to complete the foreclosure process. And, you know, I think probably both of those are extremes that maybe are not good for the housing market or for homeowners, but
right.
Somewhere in the middle is a little bit better.
Well, you've got a lot of middle ground between 90 days and 1,000 days, which is over 3 years. Like just about 3 years, right?
Yeah,
is math adding up right?
The New York process is right. It's at 1,089 days, which is just about 3 years. And
wow.
Keep in mind that's the average. We hear of situations where homeowners in New York have not been making payments for 5 years and are still in the home.
Yeah, which is also really crazy in a whole bunch of other ways. So when you guys are over at Realty Tracker analyzing the data and slicing and dicing it, are you thinking, well, I know some places are getting worse and some places are getting better, but overall, are you know, the fact that we're down 3% in foreclosure notices doesn't really mean much to me, but do you feel like overall we're over the hump, or this is the second hump and we've got more to go, or does it really depend on whether or not we're going to have another recession?
Yes, those are all great questions. I would say that we are over the hump. The one statistic that's important here is not the 3% year-over-year decrease. Yeah, is basically a non-event, I guess, unchanged. But then if you look back to 2010, the numbers nationwide are down 36% from that. And so 2010 is really when, in hindsight, we saw the peak in this foreclosure crisis with 2.9 million properties receiving foreclosure filings.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much every state is down from 2010. It's just that we have had a little bit of a roller coaster ride in some of these states where 2011 was way down as the banks adjusted some of their foreclosure procedures and practices, and now 2012 was way up because as they caught up with that and filed some of the delayed foreclosures. And so I think in those states it is a little bit of a double peak in the foreclosure problem that is going to impact the housing market in 2013, but we are past the worst of it.
What does the new normal look like, do you think? I mean, when you guys look at the whole foreclosure crisis and what's gone on, you know, with housing, I just had this conversation with someone else today about what normal means now. Earlier in the show, we were talking about how normal, we're halfway to normal, but normal, what does that actually mean? So in the world that I used to write about in real estate, normal for foreclosures was like 0.6% of Americans went into foreclosure.
Yeah.
And like 0.2% of people were just laid overall, and maybe that got as high as 4% if you were in an FHA loan. That was normal for like 20 years. What does normal look like?
Yes, I mean the best we have to go on is looking back to 2005 and 2006, which is when we started tracking this, and it was, I mean, you're actually right on target there with that 0.6% back in 2005 and 2006. It was right around that 0.5 to 0.6% of all housing units nationwide received a foreclosure notice. So we're at the peak of this in 2010, we saw 2.23%. So we hit that point, and now we're down in 2012 to 1.39%, a little over 1%, but still really more than twice what we would have expected to see in a normal market. I do think that this new normal is going to linger a little bit longer than we'd like, but we are going to get back to that well below 1% of all housing units with foreclosure notices. It's just going to take some markets longer to get there than others. You look at a market like Atlanta that has been particularly hard hit by the foreclosure crisis, and it's still at 3.51% in 2012.
And it feels high. I mean, it feels like everybody you know is going into foreclosure, and of course that's hardly the case when 96.5% of people are paying on time. Right?
Yes, yeah, it's hard to keep that in perspective that the vast, vast majority of homeowners are paying on time, but the foreclosures have a disproportionate effect. You know, you have one neighbor who's in foreclosure, and that affects everybody around them.
Right, and it does, and it will for a long time. And so, but it used to be that you would have one neighbor go into foreclosure in, you know, a pretty large metro area, but there were a lot of other housing sales at normal prices to balance that out. And I think that's actually what normal looks like. It's this ability to balance out the occasional person, the 0.6% that actually, you know, for whatever reason loses their job, there's a medical crisis, can't do anything, that goes into foreclosure versus six people on the block and nobody else can sell anything. So there's nothing to balance that off at. And I think to have normal, you have to be able to see that kind of balance come back into the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we're going to get there.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. When folks ask me what is one of the key statistics or what is the one statistic that you look at to that would tell us that the foreclosures are under control and back to normal, I look at the percentage of sales that are foreclosure sales, and which is to your point. And right now we're still hovering around 20% of all sales nationwide are properties in some stage of foreclosure. And so they are a disproportionate amount of those sales and still weighing down the overall market. When we get back to 1% to 5% of all sales being foreclosure-related, I think we'll be in a much better position, and that will be a strong sign of a fundamentally sound, healthy market.
Yeah, distressed is accounting for way more than it should. I mean, distressed sales, it's just like vacation homes were never more than 6% of the market. When they got to be 45% of the market, you knew that was a problem. Same with distressed sales overall, which is not only foreclosures, but short sales and other people in duress. I mean, it really has to come down to a much lower level, like maybe under 10%, for that to be sort of normal. Darren, thank you so much for being with us. It's been very enlightening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Darren Bloomquist, he's vice president of Realty Track. Realty Track is a company that tracks foreclosures and other real estate data for real estate investors and other folks like me who like to sound like we know what's going on, but they're the ones who really do, and you can find out more at realtytrack.com. When we come back, we're going to have a conversation more about real estate investing. I know that's a huge surprise for everybody who listens to the show week in and week out. Steve Cook, who is the managing editor of Real Estate Economy Watch, he's going to give us a little eye on what's going on with real estate investing and what's going on in his hometown of Washington, D.C. So stay tuned for that. I'm Elise Glink. We'll be right back with more Rebuilding America, One House at a Time on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One Home at a Time. So, listening to Darren's numbers from Realty Track about the foreclosure crisis, it strikes me that what we've been talking about every single week on the show is so true, and that is more than 99% of Americans in normal times, right? 99.4% of Americans pay their mortgages on time. What we've seen in the worst of the crisis is that 98% of Americans pay their mortgages on time. And there is just 2.5% of people who have been unable to make it work. And that is what a recession does. The multiplier effect is what we're talking about, right? It's the idea that you can have the greatest recession since the Great Depression in the 1920s, and yet 98% of Americans are going to get by, keep their heads down, pay those bills, make sure they're on time, and preserve their credit and their good name going forward. That's all we're really talking about. And yet, 2% has had such a corrosive effect, and millions of homeowners have had their entire net worths wiped out. And it's just devastating. And so what we're doing this year is we are going to rebuild your financial lives. We are going to give you new tools and help you rebuild your business. We're going to help you rebuild your own house. Right? Rebuild America one house at a time. It starts with you and what we're doing every single week on this show. I am so glad you're with me here today to listen to this. Go to thinklink.com. Go to my website. Sign up on any page for the free weekly newsletter. It is right there over in the corner, in the upper right corner. Sign up. Be a part of the solution as we rebuild America. Start with your house, your financial life, your business. And then spread it around so that everybody else gets to do the same. All right, stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to talk with Steve Cook. He's managing editor of the Real Estate Economy Watch. All that and more here on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Our number, 404-872-0750, but I confess we're not actually getting much on the phones today. You can tweet me at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and what I really want you to do is go to my website, thinkglink.com, T-H-I-N-K-G-L-I-N-K.com. Every week, actually it's twice a week, soon to be twice a week, we have all the information that we publish in the ThinkLink community on the Equifax Finance blog, at Yahoo, at CBS News, on ThinkLink.com, all of the places that our content appears. We've got a whole bunch of YouTube videos coming online. And, of course, next week we're going to have our nine-part series on investing in real estate webinar is going to be finished. We're going to start giving information and discounts on that. So all kinds of great information comes from ThinkLink.com. So go there and sign up and don't miss out. Don't miss out. If you follow us, you won't. I promise. All right. We've got Steve Cook on the line with us. He's managing editor of Real Estate Economy Watch, the website realestateeconomywatch.com. He also contributes to many other publications out there, including the Equifax Finance blog, where he does turn as in real estate. He and I tend to switch off. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. So, you are based in Washington, D.C., and I know you've got your eye on what's going on there. We've got a whole new, it's a whole new year. We've got our president just re-inaugurated. We've got all kinds of really big real estate problems sort of hanging out there. And I know you're focused on sort of real estate investing at the moment. Tell me, what are you seeing? What's going on with investors around the country right now?
Well, you know, the whole area of real estate investing in terms of buying a home and renting it out is really huge today. 27% of all people living in a rental today are living in a single-family home. And more than half of all the rental facilities are single-family homes today. So it's something that's just a mushroom during the housing depression. The key quick question now is looking forward is will this continue to be such a large and viable part of the residential real estate picture? And the short-term answer is certainly yes. The demand for people who want to rent one of these homes is huge. And in fact, it's more people want to rent a single-family home than an apartment. So the supply has been growing, but it's still not growing fast enough to meet the need. So that's number one. And number two, the supply of foreclosures, which has been providing the properties for these rentals, is still, you know, fairly large in a lot of markets around the country. It varies depending on where you are. But, you know, we still have somewhere in the vicinity of well over a million foreclosures that are in the foreclosure pipeline that probably will end up being rental properties.
So we just had Darren Blomquist on from Realty Track, and he was telling us that it's kind of shifted this, except for poor Illinois, which still is at the bottom of the list, and Georgia's, or the top of the list, Georgia too. But there are a lot of other states that used to be very high in the list, like Arizona and Nevada, that have now dropped dramatically in terms of numbers of foreclosures. But you're seeing states like New Jersey, which are much more highly populated, and those are actually exploding with foreclosures. What kind of an effect do you think that's just going to have? I know your background originally is with the National Association of Realtors. They've just got to have their heads down.
Well, yes, the fact is that these foreclosures, when they're being bought up by people turning them into rentals, do create demand in the marketplace for homes, and that helps everybody. That helps the homeowners and their values. But one of the other things that's going on as you look at the changing geography of foreclosures is that in some of the markets, particularly the traditional foreclosure markets that we think about, such as Phoenix and Las Vegas, then the California markets and markets in Florida, have a shrinking foreclosure discount. That's the difference between what a home would sell for at full price versus that same home if it were a foreclosure. Traditionally, that discount's been something like 30%, which actually helps finance the investor who comes in and buys it and fixes it up, because that investor is going to put $7,000 to $10,000 on average into that foreclosure. In places like Phoenix and places like Las Vegas right now, that discount is so small it's almost negligible. So one of the things that if you're looking to buy an investment property, you need to think about is the fact that in some markets today, the discounts are shrinking. On the other hand, like some of the other markets you're talking about, many in the Northeast and Midwest, that discount is still very large, and it could be 30, even as large as 40%.
Yeah, the discount is really interesting because, what I don't understand yet is how the numbers of short sales that are out there, and as the market goes up and values rise, some of those properties that were just on the edge are starting to go positive again, which is great news for those homeowners. But there's still like a huge chunk of Americans who are underwater. For the first time ever, we're seeing this kind of massive long-term drag. And they can't refinance in many cases. They can't get out without, coming to the table with a huge chunk of cash that they don't have. And those property prices have to still be getting dragged down by whatever foreclosures are out there, right?
Yeah, that's true. It's a vicious cycle. The negative equity that's out there keeps people from buying. It keeps people from selling. It's one of the major causes for the very small inventories that we have in homes for sale in many markets, in the country, particularly in places like California, where negative equity is significant.
I heard a story today about a friend of mine who has a house outside of Detroit in a sort of a fancy neighborhood, and he bought it at the bottom, what turned out to be the bottom of the market, November of 2009. So that's good for him. But he said, this is exciting news. There's a house that just sold on my block for a lot more per square foot than I paid. And I said, that's good news. Maybe that means that things are turning around in your neighborhood. And he went home to talk to his wife about it. And she said, yes, dear, except that I looked at that house 4.5 years ago. It's been on the market for 4.5 years. The owners just decided they weren't going to drop the price. And so finally, they were able to get their price, but it took them nearly 5 years. And so, the idea that, and there are no other houses for sale in the neighborhood or on the block, it's hard to even know what that means, other than it wasn't a foreclosure and, they didn't go broke selling it.
Yeah, and that is, frankly, an anomaly today. During the past 18 months, nationally, we've seen the time on market significantly decline across the country. Right now, it's about 10% below where it was a year ago in terms of the number of days that a house spends on the market before it's sold. And that's a function largely of the short inventories rather than really strong demand. The inventories are down 20%, and they've been that way all year, so that many realtors and home buyers are having a problem finding houses to buy in some markets simply because the selection is so slim.
So what I see that might happen, and you should weigh in on this, is that you get slim pickings, so then the price starts to go up, right, which is a good thing. And then more people go, look at that. And they put their houses on the market, and the price goes down again. And so you get this, whereas we couldn't really find the bottom for so long, and I think now we've probably turned the corner in most markets, even in Atlanta we've turned the corner. But yet, this idea that we're going to be on some sort of massive upswing and it's just going to go all full speed ahead, that's not rebuilding America. That's just another bubble forming.
Well, yeah, and, the whole idea of inventories kind of leading the way in the recovery is really backwards. I mean, traditionally, it's the way it's supposed to work is demand is supposed to lead the way rather than short supply. And then when demand reduces inventory, then you would have more houses come on the market, et cetera. Instead, what we're seeing is that inventory declines, which are due to several things. One of them, the major one I already mentioned, which is negative equity.
Right.
Another is that prices just haven't gone up enough for, because people can't afford to sell, even if they are in positive equity. And then finally, we've had a real decline in the number of foreclosures for sale in a lot of states where there have been backlogs of processing, which is a whole other issue. But and the other one of the things about the inventory also is that the less expensive the home you're looking at, the shorter the supply these days. In other words, it's the entry level home, the starter home for the first time home buyer. Those are the homes that are really in short supply. You get up toward the luxury property, and there's a much larger supply of those out there.
Mm. So when you're out there talking about investing in real estate, where do you tell people to look these days? I mean, is it still like you should buy a foreclosure? Or, I mean, we did a story for CBS News the other day called What Can You Buy for $11,000 or Less? And in the Atlanta area, people are like, yeah, you can buy that, but of course you'll have be target practice for somebody. What are you telling people to look for?
Well, I think there are a lot of foreclosures and short sales out there. You mentioned short sales. There are probably as many short sales on the market today as foreclosures because a lot of sellers have opted to go that route.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's a question of geography. I think that there are markets. You mentioned Chicago. I mean, that's a good one where there are still significant foreclosure discount and there are a lot of properties available as foreclosures. In some of the other areas that have been more of the traditional foreclosure markets, the pickings are a lot slimmer. There's one other thing going on with buying foreclosures, and that is we've had some very, very, very well-financed hedge funds from Wall Street move into the residential real estate business, the Ariota rental business it's called, and buy up not just dozens but hundreds and hundreds of foreclosures in order to create their own businesses where they're managing these properties. Then they hope to actually create securities from them and sell them on Wall Street. But this has actually helped to increase the price of foreclosures and reduce that discount. So they tend to be more active in Florida, in Arizona, in Nevada, and in California, some of those traditional markets where you've had a lot of foreclosures in the past, as opposed to Cleveland, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, a lot of those markets where there are significant numbers of foreclosures that are coming to market. Many of them have been backlogged in the process, and where the discounts for foreclosures are still substantial.
So we just have a minute or two left. What do you see coming down the pike in D.C.? I know it's your backyard, and you follow it very closely. And we're just at the beginning of what we've had the inauguration this week. You know, we're at the beginning. Is this the year that we're going to see Fannie and Freddie and something happen there? Is this the year that we're going to see some major housing movements? What are we going to see?
You know, I kind of think it is the year that we see something significant happening with Fannie and Freddie. In Washington speak, those are called the GSEs, or the government-sponsored enterprises. It's been since 2009. It's hard to believe, but it's been that long since the Treasury Department took over Fannie and Freddie and have been operating them basically as government agencies. And it's been that long as we've tried to figure out what to do with them in terms of what the future might be. One of the objectives has been to create a private market for the mortgages that similar to what Fannie and Freddie securitized on their market, on their secondary market, and that's starting to happen. The secondary market, the private label secondary market, is starting to happen, which is a good thing.
Right.
In order to have some competition. So I do think that there's a consensus behind the scenes, kind of quietly, about what this, you know, what we want to have in these agencies, what we want to have it look like. We don't want it to have it go away. We want to continue to have it possible for home buyers to have their mortgages purchased and securitized, and that which will help the whole home buying process. And so I think that we may be able to see something go forward this year when we don't have the kind of pressure that we had last year and the year before with the elections.
Right, and that truly is just a vice grip that everything is sort of withered under. Steve Cook is managing editor of Real Estate Economy Watch. You can find him at Equifax Finance blog. Just click on the Real Estate tab. We'll put some links up at thinkglink.com on the blog today so that you can talk to him and to all of our guests, and we hope that you do that. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you, Elise. Have a great year.
Thank you. You do the same, and I'm sure we'll talk to you before the year is out. Stay tuned, everybody. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, here on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Live on Sundays here on News Talk WSB, Rebuilding America One House at a Time. And we're starting with yours. Online, all the time, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. I want you to go to the website. On the website, in the upper right-hand corner, is a little box, and it says sign up for the free weekly newsletter. And I want you to go and do that because every single week when that newsletter comes out, we give you access to all of the content in the ThinkLink community. CBS News, over at Yahoo, the Equifax Finance blog, what's going on at ThinkLink.com. And there's so much that we're working on right now. So much. We have these incredible real estate investing webinars called The Intentional Investor. They are almost finished. They're going to be out in just a couple of weeks, and we want you to have access to them and understand what it is that we're able to do for you right now. We want you to follow us on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and if you follow me, you'll again get access to really interesting information. We are curating the very best that's going to help you rebuild your life. Financial news, real estate news, investing news, small business news, all of that we are curating every single day at Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So looking back over the last 2 hours, I have to tell you, I'm so thrilled with the information that we got. I don't know about you, I learned so much today. I mean, Jed Kolko from Trulia really understands, just because that website has 4 million listings. That website every day updates what's going on with real estate around the country. They've got thousands and thousands of real estate agents that participate. They have this incredibly active community online. And the information that he gave us about what's going on in Atlanta, I thought was incredibly helpful and timely. And if you are trying to sell your house or thinking about buying a house, you need to understand that Georgia and Atlanta specifically is not out of the woods. We're not there yet. This is just a lot of other states, Arizona, Nevada, they're getting better. Georgia, just a teeny tiny bit. Foreclosure notices down 4% in Georgia as opposed to 3%. And that's an improvement over last year. That's great. But we're not there yet. So what you have to do week in and week out is come back to News Talk WSB at 11 o'clock. Join us as we talk through the issues of the day, and I help you rebuild America, rebuild your America, your house, your financial life, your business. Your house is the one we're focusing on. Thanks so much for joining me and our guests today. Tune in next week at 11, and in the meantime, I'll expect to see you on Twitter and at thinklink.com. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Have a great week.